This episode of Special Sauce is being brought to you by W.W. Norton & Company, publisher of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts, written by Stella Parks, Serious Eats' very own pastry wizard. In Brave Tart, Stella shares foolproof recipes for classic American desserts. Think sugar cookies, animal crackers, candy bars, and frosted yellow cake. With a historian's rigor and a scientist's curiosity, Stella documents the intriguing stories of how our favorite sweets came to be, and this is key, and the best methods for recreating these classics at home. As someone who has had the not-so-difficult task of tasting many of the treats Stella was developing for her book, I can personally attest to their serious deliciousness. So, if you want to delight your family and friends with homemade versions of the sweets we all grew up with, pick up a copy of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts, wherever books are sold. Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we interview some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
One of the catchphrases for clients to say is, you know, I'd really like a timeless design. Well, who would not like a timeless design? But timeless design has to be a result, not an intention. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're afraid to go through timely to get to timeless, you end up with petrified.
Today, we are continuing our far-reaching conversation with the inimitable David Rockwell. Today, we're going to get into his work in the theater in greater detail, in hotels, in public spaces, and how he's gone from simply being an innovative designer and architect to having a company with how many employees now?
A few.
What? It's like hundreds, dude. It's not a few. You have many employees, and you have offices like in Madrid, don't you? And
we have an office in Madrid. We have about 240 people in New York, model makers, architects, interior designers, writers, technologists.
That's insane.
And about six dogs on a daily basis. That's the best part.
So, is one of those dogs yours?
My dog does not come into the office because I'm not there enough.
But, got it.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your work in the theater, because when I first met you, you weren't doing any work in the theater. You were just doing restaurants. You had sort of become the restaurant designer, not just in New York, but around the country and outside the country. And last week you talked about your mom running this essentially this summer stock theater in Deal, New Jersey. But how did you officially make the transformation? And was it intentionally just like, you know what, I really want to attack this? Like, how did it come about?
What was intentional was the realization that I needed to find links in other areas I was interested in that would leverage off of our work in restaurants. So what we had become known for was work in restaurants. And so there were easier places where I could make that pivot. And the reason I was interested in is I felt like things like airports. You know, you would arrive at an airport in New York, really at any one of the three airports, and the experience was so poor.
And nobody would disagree with
and
you.
And so
there.
Lacking. I mean, screw hospitality. You know,
it was survival. It was Darwinian survival.
It was. So there were areas that quite literally we would spend 4 or 5 years talking about, researching, finding people within that world to connect with, to take a lot of my thinking and our thinking in design and move that into other areas. So that led to the Children's Hospital at Montefiore, which opened in early 2002. But had been in the works for, I think, 5 or 6 years, and really a revelatory project for us to apply our thinking about. So that led to work in other areas like the JetBlue Terminal, hotels really globally, schools, the Blue School, the Imagination Playground.
The Blue School is for the Blue Man Group.
It's for Matt Goldman, who's one of the Blue Men, started this school. That is now we're doing a new school for them, which will be a high school. We did the lower school and the middle school.
And so it's an actual school. It's not a training.
No, it's an actual school, and it's a very well-respected school that is sort of deeper in the visual art.
Wow. So you started doing all kinds of things.
So what was intentional?
Public spaces.
Yeah, what was intentional is our interest in a wider range of public spaces, while still being fascinated in the world of restaurants and doing more and more restaurants connected to hotels and independent restaurants. The theater piece, I was invited to speak at the TED conference and did this talk on the relationship of theater and architecture, and I started to think more about that. And I have a lot of friends who work in the theater world, and the question had been posed to me, why wasn't I doing work in the theater? And as I remember it, the first time that was posed in a way that was provocative was Jules Fisher.
The lighting designer.
The lighting designer. We were leaving a show that we had seen together, and I was critiquing the set. And he said, well—
I'm shocked that you are critiquing the set.
I was doing it nicely, like you call that crap a set. And his response was, I'm paraphrasing, well, if you're so smart, why aren't you doing that? My response was, it feels like even though – and I had spent time with Roger Morgan. I'd spent some time studying theater, and I certainly was a student of theater. How would I – that felt like such a large reach. And he gave me fantastic advice, which is just start to meet with directors and understand what their needs are.
Right.
Well, it was basically the conversation I was having with Nobu, but now with directors. So – and it took several years of meeting with directors, sketching solutions. Different things came and went. And then I was offered my first Broadway show from Chris Ashley, who just directed Come From Away. He actually won Best Director this year.
At the Tonys.
And Jordan Roth, who now runs Drew Jampson Theaters, but was just – this was his first Broadway show. And they said, David – would you like to design the Broadway production of the Rocky Horror Show? Well, I'd never seen the Rocky Horror Show, having spent, 12 to 18 in Guadalajara. I was watching.
You missed that.
I missed it. I watched Cantinflas and Bullfights. And so I went home and watched the movie, and I came back and I said, guys, why would anyone want to do this? I don't, from watching it on the movies, I don't get what the magic is. And they said, it is about empowering the audience, and it's about self-creation. And I had been thinking, well, if I'm going to do theater, maybe it would be like Cherry Orchard and BAM. It would be the academic
yes,
side.
Yes.
So I said yes. And Ed, it was the absolute perfect first show.
Really?
Because there were, first of all, not a lot of expectations. And it had this phenomenal transformation from the beginning when you go from the movie theater world into the world of the Rocky Horror Show.
Yeah, fascinating. So that became the Little Shop of Horrors, right? When it opened on Broadway, right?
It was a revival of the Rocky Horror Show that became the movie, the Rocky Horror Picture Show. So in the revival that we did starred Dick Cavett and all kinds of amazing people.
Wow. Did you go, wow, why did it take me so long? This is awesome. I mean, were you overwhelmed with like, I really want to do a lot more in this sphere?
No, I was struck with the fact that the same notion of sushi zen that I did, where it was life and death, I worked to get the silk mural on the wall perfect, or the Feast of the Many Moons when lashing the moons was critical, or the first Nobu where quite literally the opening day we were still putting up those birch trees as Drew and the team were yelling at us to get it done. That sense of every detail, goes into creating an extraordinarily memorable experience was something that stuck with me through all the rehearsals of the Rocky Horror Show. It was an amazing lesson in a couple things. One is it was in Circle in the Square Theater, which is very limited. It's in the round. There's no fly loft. And I found those limitations pushed the design into interesting directions.
What's a fly loft?
There was no way to fly scenery out Broadway theater, so you couldn't do that. So I was totally bitten. And then the next opportunity, which is luck on the most incredible level, is Jerry Mitchell, the choreographer of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, said, David, I'd like you to meet Jack O'Brien. We're doing a musical based on Hairspray and wondering if you'd like to design it. So we went to lunch at a coffee shop. I listened to the music, of course, fell in love with it. And so my second show was Hairspray.
Wow. That's amazing. And was your mom around to see this?
No, unfortunately, I lost my mom when we were living in Mexico. She died when I was 15. It did trigger all those memories of early days in the community theater with her. And I invited two of the people from Deal, New Jersey, who had been a part of her show to the opening of Rocky Horror Show.
That's great. And so now you're doing Shakespeare in the Park. And has your thinking about theater evolved?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, my thinking about all of it has evolved. What's remained the same is my fascination with the relationship of permanence and memory. Right? I mean, theater is there for 2.5 hours, but it creates memories that last forever, the same a great meal that you have.
Right. So you're really attracted to what resonates.
Yeah. You know, we're now working on this cultural center called The Shed on the High Line, this new ground-up visual and performing arts cultural institution that also moves. So there's an element of transformation embedded in that. And so I think we find the resonance changes from project, but there's certain things that continue. And then there's, you know, it's one of the things about design is it's always new. You know, the fact that this summer I'm doing Shakespeare in the Park at the Delacorte Theater is such a dream come true. I came to New York, went to the Delacorte all the time. Central Park was my backyard. And now I'm working there with maybe 100 interns right out of school who all love what they do. And it is inspiring to be working in an area where you can, you know, and I can bring what I bring to the table.
Right, and you can pay it forward.
Exactly.
You're dealing with people, whether they're directors or producers or restaurateurs or chefs, people with strong ideas themselves. So how do you deal with the inherent conflict that's going to come up between talented people with different ideas about things?
Well, I think you try to sort out in the conversation before you take the project about whether there's a sort of common ground,
mm-hmm.
which, one of my favorite directors, Jack O'Brien, likes to say, one of his lines is, don't put a hat on a hat. And from a design point of view, I take that to mean you don't want to engage in a project where everyone's going to do the same thing. So if you have a client that feels like they know what they want visually, that's a little constricting. I'd rather work with a client who knows what they want emotionally, knows where they want it to land.
Right, and you can then translate that.
Yeah, because then I'm learning from them.
You know,
we learn from all our clients. There's something there to learn. So you try and sort out at the beginning, is there an opportunity to really play together? And I'll give you one really interesting example right now is we're renovating the Helen Hayes Theater.
On Broadway.
On Broadway, the smallest Broadway theater, 600 seats, second stage.
Could you make the seats more comfortable, please?
They're going to look more comfortable.
That's not the answer. Not the answer I wanted.
The trick is short plays.
Right.
So we're renovating this landmark theater, landmark inside and out, Ed. So lots of restrictions. And the client had a lot of requirements and lots of thoughts about making it contemporary. Well, there is a real collision there between the landmark status in the interior and second stage's image as a contemporary American company. But that tension led to a solution that I am so thrilled about, and that opens in March. But that came out of that exact collision. And I can't tell you how many bad ideas we came up with together to get to the point where we had a solution that really worked. But that was the client being persistent and us being strong about listening and hearing and trying different things.
It's really the difference.
And the client is Carol Rothman, by the way, who runs Second Stage.
So there's a good kind of creative tension, a productive kind of creative tension, and then there's negative creative tension.
Which I think is fear-based.
Mm-hmm. And so you—
And my feeling is if a client's that cautious, they shouldn't do it.
Right, right, right. So one of the interesting things to me when I observed your career is you have a zillion people working for you, and yet you're someone who has lots of ideas. What do you look for in people, and how do you have you managed to build a company, a very large company? Like, I built Series Seeds, but it was 15 people. You know, you've built a company with hundreds of people, insanely talented, lots of ideas, many original thinkers. How does it all coalesce? And that's a tall order.
I actually don't know the answer to the question, because it was never a driver of mine to have a big or small company. The driver was to do things that intrigued me, and to work with a kind of collection of people who inspired me, and we hopefully inspired them.
So you don't hire yes people?
I think we are very much a kind of mission-based group. So the people who want to work with Rockwell Group are people who – and it is interesting when students get right out of school, when they come to work with us, what they want to do is put every idea they ever had into the first project.
Of course, because it's like young musicians or young chefs. They want to put every ingredient in every dish.
Yeah. And so I think there's a kind of learning curve. But then what ultimately emerges is a group of people who were sort of unified by this mission – of creating places and environments and objects that really connect people in a sort of deep way. In terms of how I've managed to do it.
Yeah, how do you find that out, like in an interview or from looking at a portfolio?
One of the things I'm looking for is people who are still curious. You of course need people with skills, and you need people who still love what they do. There has to be a joy in what they do. And one of the ways, sort of the last interview question I like to ask people is, what are the things they think they do that are extraordinary? You know, what is your insight into the world that you think is exceptional? And I don't want to hear a general answer. I want to hear whether
Yeah, you don't
want
to hear great work.
I want to hear whether it's, you know, color or movement or texture or research. And so the other, I think, key to it being a great place to work is there are four or five extraordinary leaders who lead teams of people. The core infrastructure group, all of them have been there for north of 20 years, so there's a real sense of family. And we love what we do. I think that comes across. I think it's sort of self-selecting. Now, it doesn't always work. Sometimes the system.
You can't bat a thousand.
You can't bat a thousand. So I think it's a combination of clear mission. And then one of the challenges is to constantly give them the opportunity to make mistakes. One of the catchphrases for clients to say is, you know, I'd really like a timeless design. Well, who would not like a timeless design? But timeless design has to be a result, not an intention. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're afraid to go through timely to get to timeless, you end up with petrified.
Right, right. It's interesting. So you're actually looking for people who have decided at a pretty young age that they're not afraid of failure, or they're not afraid of their own fear.
Totally true. On the other hand, on project management, you don't want careless people.
Right. Yes.
You know, I asked Danny Meyer a question once about how he was able to hire and how he trained his team to be so varied and hospitable, because there's not a typical waiter. They're all quirky and different. And his answer was he has to hire them that way.
So, right.
You know, part of it is getting the right people at the beginning. Mm-hmm.
You know, what keeps you excited about what you're doing?
I mean, it's impossible to answer that, because it just feels like it is.
It's who you are.
I just wake up energized by the opportunities in front of us. Now, there are days when, you know, there are three projects that are screwing up and everything's behind schedule and budgets are too high. And those are days where you have to try and kind of sort through all of those myriad problems and get back to why you're doing it and try and connect to the client on that level too.
I assume people come to you because they must feel that you have some way to discern the future. And yet, when you do research, you sort of become obsessed with history. So how do you reconcile those two things?
I think what you have to do is find a sort of common goal. We do quite a bit of work for Google and Facebook, for instance, as two companies who think about the future and are very engaged in the future. The challenge is to listen to what they want and propose something that, like all the best ideas, it seems obvious once you suggest it.
Right.
And in many cases, we can be, you know, good objective listeners to figure out how to tell the story they want to tell in a way that they wouldn't have been able to figure out because they're too inside the,
right,
the problem or the challenge. You also need to start with writing a narrative together with a client defining what the goal is so they know when it's met that goal.
If you both agree on the story you're telling, then you're more likely to arrive at something that you're both be happy with.
Yeah, we're working with a music company right now, a very big music company that has multiple labels, and we're doing a new home for them. So interestingly, each label has different requirements, but the key to that was the spaces they all share and get them to be committed to greater spaces that are shared spaces and not just think about the individual spaces. And sort of design can almost zoom in on that level of problem.
Is there a frontier that you haven't explored that you'd like to in terms of kinds of projects? Like, I mean, the breadth of the work that you're engaged in is astonishing. I can't think of a sphere that you're not working, but is there something that you go, God, I'd love to do a sports stadium, or I'd love to figure out a different way to design baseball dugouts? You know, like, is there something like that that you're that sort of hang there like a piece of fruit that you'd love to pluck from the tree?
Yeah, there's many, many, you know, many of those. And some of them are cases there's people we'd like to collaborate with, chefs, hotels. You know, we just finished doing the design of a train connection called Brightline in Florida, where we actually designed the interior and the exterior of the train. That was a first. But there are many things that are on our to-do list. And more and more, what started to happen that was really unexpected is the interest in theater and architecture have connected in a way I never saw. So this pop-up TED theater we did in Vancouver, 1,300-seat theater for the TED conference, it sets up in 5 days and goes away in 2 days and then sets up every year. I'm very interested in pop-up right now, because I think it's a way to animate public spaces in a kind of intriguing way.
Right. And with the appearance and reality of great spontaneity.
Yeah. And a sense of ritual. I think, you know, it's one of the things that connects with people. Very interested in park design. I guess part of it is from spending so much time in Central Park and just thinking about, like, what a lifesaver that is for New York,
sure,
that space.
And in all cities, parks,
yeah,
the role that parks play in people's lives. And what's interesting to me is that the role that parks play cuts across ethnic, cultural, and socioeconomic lines.
Totally. Sitting in the Delacorte Theater when 1,800 and 1,900 strangers come together from all walks of life and they become a community around the story and the visual storytelling, that's like gold, you know.
Those are the moments you live for.
Amazing experience. I'm very interested in, from a design point of view, things that feel like they could be better. You mentioned stadiums. I don't understand why stadiums are used 12 days a year. It just seems bizarre. So I think down the road there's some interesting solution about the merger of public and private space and reinventing those spaces.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's lots of them yet to go, thank God.
Keeps you interested. So now it's time for the special sauce all-you-can-answer buffet. No pressure. We don't have like a gong. So you can take your time. And it's just some fun questions we ask everybody.
I didn't know about the buffet.
Yeah, that's all right. So you're going to handle it. Yeah, I know you.
I'm trying.
Who's at your last supper? No family allowed. You can have 4 or 5 people, could be living or dead.
So we're going to call this the morbid question.
Yeah, it's the morbid question. I should figure out a way to rephrase it so it's not the Last Supper.
Well, I tell you what pops into mind is in the last 6 months, I've started playing piano again.
Okay.
Played as a kid and So I started working with this amazing teacher and playing a lot of Bach, which I never played before.
So you want Bach at the dinner?
No, I want Vladimir Horowitz at the dinner.
You want Vladimir? All right, I love this.
Because I want it. I want him to play the stuff I'm listening to, and I just need to understand how is that humanly possible.
Right. Okay, that's good. There's one. Keep going. You got three more people.
There's four people at the
dinner.
Yeah. I guess I would want Julia Childs at the dinner, so there's someone cooking, and I've always wanted to talk. I connected with her a little bit towards the end, but not enough.
Mm-hmm.
So someone to provide the food, someone
okay.
to provide the music. Maybe I would have Boris Aronson there.
Who's Boris Aronson?
Boris Aronson was the greatest set designer of the 20th century.
Wow.
And designed all of the great Hal Prince classics. So he'd be there to design the environment.
Okay.
I'd have my mom there.
Well, I said no family, but I'm going to let you have your mom. You're good.
I ignored that rule.
So what are you eating?
Definitely the chicken from Barbuto.
Okay. So that's perfectly roasted chicken.
Perfectly roasted chicken under a brick.
Right. Crisp skin, moist flesh, the whole bit.
Yeah. Rhubarb pie that my mom made.
Ooh. Just rhubarb, not strawberry rhubarb.
Just rhubarb.
And was it slightly tart as a result?
Very tart, yes. It had kind of
interesting
pre-yuzu tartness.
Pre-yuzu. That's hilarious.
Oh, God, it's such pressure. I might have, I'd have an incredible steak since I'm a huge steak fan. It would probably be my favorite steak at the moment is the steak for two that they offer. You have to special order it. At La Conda Verde,
and it's a bone and ribeye, is it not?
Right.
Yeah. Okay, and would be dry aged and appropriately.
Yeah. Is that enough?
That's good. But you know, I think if your mother were alive, she'd really want you to have some vegetables.
Some vegetables.
Or a salad or something, David.
Can the salad be the tuna sashimi salad from Nobu? So we get the.
Yes.
Because then you eat the lettuce, but you really pay attention
right.
to the tuna sashimi.
I like that.
Yeah.
That's perfect. Do you cook? You cook yourself, right?
I do.
So what do you cook when there's not much in your house to work with? Like if you've come home late and you want to rustle up something to eat for you and your wife, your kids or whatever, what would you make?
I would make a stir fry.
Okay.
And it would have some form of meat in it.
Whatever's in the fridge.
Whatever's in the fridge.
Chicken, beef, whatever.
Yeah. Probably onions, maybe some shallots, throw some spinach in there. And if we had old Chinese food, I would take the rice with some butter and probably add an egg with the stuff and make a kind of fried rice.
Yeah. I like this.
Yeah.
I like this. Can I come?
You're there.
All right. That's good. Do you have a guilty pleasure?
One form of guilty pleasure is I know I'm not supposed to eat a lot of red meat, but I would say when I'm feeling most indulgent, it would be a great steak dinner.
Yeah.
That would be an indulgence.
A great steak is a guilty pleasure. I mean, you don't have to have it every day, but yeah.
It wouldn't hurt.
No, it wouldn't hurt. Who's the one person? And for you, I have to add the caveat that it's someone you don't know.
Yeah.
That you'd love to break bread with and just hear how they think about the world and what they do.
Oh, definitely Frank Lloyd Wright.
Frank Lloyd Wright.
Definitely.
Even though that's interesting because Frank Lloyd Wright certainly created immersive experiences, but I think unlike him, you make very user-friendly and resident.
I'm going to switch to Picasso.
You are. All right. See, now that makes more sense to me.
But the reason I mentioned Frank Lloyd Wright is I've been reading a whole series of books. I just read The Women, which is the novel based on the women in his life. I just saw the exhibit at MoMA. But the truth is, and I just saw the George O'Keefe exhibit at the Brooklyn Museum that closed yesterday, and there was something about George O'Keefe's, her lifestyle and her work being the same thing, which was true with Frank Lloyd Wright. So I know a lot about him. Picasso, I think Picasso would be more fun to sit and talk with and get him to scribble on a napkin. God,
oh,
can you imagine?
God,
one
no.
napkin scribble, I'd be
Picasso,
set.
Picasso, you know, when they had that retrospective, that Picasso retrospective is one of the most amazing things,
yeah.
you know, to see the breadth of his work. In that way, it's sort of does remind me of what you do, obviously, in a different sphere. But he was so curious about the world.
He was.
You know, it was fascinating. So it's just been declared David Rockwell Day. What happens all over the world on that day?
God, what happens on David Rockwell Day? That is a surreal question. I think there's a festival all day long. I think there's one connected street fair that happens locally and are all connected, and then we gather the lessons of what are the best street fairs. And because I think street fairs, talk about something that needs reinvention.
And, oh, my God.
And, you know, we did a book called Spectacle that looked at festivals around the world, particularly the Holi Festival in India with beautiful powder. So I think it's a kind of art-influenced street fair that happens around the world that's documented in a film.
Wow. I love this. We're going to make David Rockwell Day happen.
I'm there.
All right, man. Well, thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, David Rockwell.
Thank you.
It was awesome. To see the fruits of the David Rockwell Group's labor, you can walk into any Noble on the planet. You can stay in one of the hotels he's designed. You can go see a show on Broadway for which he designed the set, or in many places in the world, just walk out your front door or your office. This episode of Special Sauce has been brought to you by W.W. Norton & Company, publisher of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts, the first book by resident Serious Eats pastry wizard Stella Parks. The recipes in Brave Tart are awesome, original, and rigorously tested. That's why they really do work. Plus, Stella is so smart, so curious, and such a good writer, you can happily read Brave Tart from cover to cover. I have. Like it wasn't a cookbook. It's equal parts science, history, and sweets mythology explained and debunked. I know what you're thinking. As a Serious Eats overlord, I'm hopelessly biased when it comes to Stella. And I probably am. But you too will think she's swell when you get your own copy of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts, wherever books are sold. And we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters. Thanks again, David. It was great.
Thank you.